Welcome to a series of podcasts from the Vegan Information Project. In each podcast, we'll be exploring in greater depth many of the issues that arose during the workshops facilitated by Tina Cubley towards the end of the VIP mini course on social movements. Right, here I am then with Tina Cubley. So it's Roger Yates and Tina Cubley. We're completing the VIP podcast number one. So this is kind of 1A, if you like. And so we're just going to tie a few loose ends, cross a few T's and dot a few I's, as they say. So the first issue, Tina, that I wanted to clarify with you was the thing that I mentioned about the Welsh example that I gave, which is that some people, when they think about intersectionality, they'd have certain things which would spring to their mind, and they'd be kind of uncontroversial, you know, anti-sexism, anti-racism, anti-ableism in particular, along with anti-speciesism. So that would be their kind of construction in their mind. When you then introduce, as a matter of theory and practicality, anarchy and anti-capitalism, that's when people seem to start to get a bit objectional to this idea. You know, that seems to be, you know, what we've experienced so far. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. I think there's a lot of deliberate and self-serving misconceptions about what anarchy means and what an anarchist society would actually look like. I think one reason for that is that, at least in affluent Western society, we have internalised the myth of the capitalist system's inevitability, which is, of course, something political theorist Herbert Marcuse deals with in some detail, and which we're going to deal with in some detail. Everyone will be delighted to hear in our next podcast. But
that's an advert for podcast two already.
Yes, that's right. I'm shamelessly marketing our podcasts. But yes, I think those with the power, with some measure of power to make their voices heard, have not yet come to understand capitalism as the violence which it is. All the arguments we get against incorporating an understanding of capitalism as intrinsically harmful, inevitably violent, into our intersectional analysis of social justice, all the arguments we get against that have within them some strand of this is the way things have always been, this is the way things will always be. You have to work with people where they're at. You know, you can't expect people to give up everything. Instead of getting back everything, which is how I would understand the anti-capitalist movement, getting back everything meaningful from capitalism and throwing out everything we didn't need in the first place, they see that as giving up everything. Because, you know, the capitalist system compensates people for their loss of freedom really well, unless you happen to be on the wrong side of it.
Well, you know, you work all your life and we'll give you a wage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, there's not much freedom there, you know, follow the rules and everything else. Yeah.
No, but I think the rationale behind it all is that capitalism itself has redefined freedom, which I know this sounds really Orwellian, but they take all the words that we believe should mean something and they reconstruct them to mean something quite different. Like now, in capitalist society, if you are privileged by capitalism, your oppression within that same system is hidden from you because freedom to you has come to mean consumer luxuries and foreign holidays and a prestigious job and all this superfluous fluff that capitalism offers in return for trading in everything meaningful, trading in your freedom. So basically what we're seeing here is people wanting to hang on to their privilege, but they can't say that because that doesn't sound very nice. So one of the things you get when you talk about anti-capitalism is, that's too big, it's too threatening, it's too, no, you can't sell that to anybody. And here we get the sell word yet again, which shows us the mentality we're dealing with, which is one which is internalised capitalist oppression. But that's the objection you get. You can't sell it. It's too threatening to people. And
it makes our job harder. Could you say a little bit more about this idea that capitalism is violent? Because I think a lot of people there would probably be thinking about, well, we're just talking about human nature, not capitalism. And so we've got violent humans in any system. Whereas yours is a kind of structural approach, which means that the society shapes the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a classic social anarchist understanding of privilege and oppression, in that individual violence on an individual level, is created and enabled by the society we live in. For example, where does domestic violence come from? It comes from patriarchy. It comes from patriarchal society. So where does all the violence we see around us come from in affluent Western society? It comes from capitalism. I mean, I do challenge you right now, because that will be interesting, to think of a single example of a form of significant violence against individuals that we witness or experience in the society, which is not in some way traceable back to capitalism.
Okay, well, I suppose I'd say rape, but if I'm asking you a question, you know, give an example of violence. I think people might be struggling to equate capitalism with violence.
Let me explain that in more detail then. But before I do so, as a radical feminist and an anarchist with an intersectional understanding of how patriarchy and capitalism enable one another, I would say that violence against women is intimately involved and inextricably linked to capitalism. I mean, I could go in great detail into how, for example, the marketing of consumer goods, the marketing of fashion, the very marketing of how your body should look to women, that's all violence. You know, it's inextricably linked to rape culture. You know, so capitalism sells rape, ultimately. That's what it's selling, rape culture.
Yeah.
But on a broader level, capitalism as violence. I was thinking about that the other day when I was speaking to somebody about the idea of legal persons. And I was thinking, I illustrated what I was thinking by saying that we have legal persons now, like Tesco's, which are crammed full of food, while real persons on the street are empty and starving. You know, it's just that, for me, is an emblem of how capitalism is violent. Hunger is violence. And devaluation of people is violence. I mean, I need hardly add, for all the animal advocates out there who are resistant to the idea of intersectionality and don't want to see capitalism as being part of our problem, or at least not the first item on our agenda. I mean, my challenge to that is that there isn't a first item on our agenda. There cannot be. We must have an intersectional understanding of what we're facing. Otherwise, we just can't build the world that we want one thing at a time, because all these things enable each other. They're just part of a violent world. You know, if you think that capitalism is not a problem with regard to exploitation of our fellow animals, I mean, what about industrialised animal use, you know? It's just, take capitalism out of the equation. Take an exchange economy out of the equation. What happens to all the animal use that's for profit? I mean, David Nybert goes into this, obviously, much, and explains it much better than I am doing. He is recommended, by the way, to all the listeners. But, essentially, what he is saying is that it's not only a case that different forms of oppression feed off each other, it's that they are ultimately the same form of oppression and that they serve each other. Speciesism serves capitalism, for example. You know,
this is where he's getting the entanglement idea.
Yeah, exactly, because without speciesism, without a profoundly speciesist way of looking at our fellow beings, well, capitalism would be much more shaky than it is, because capitalism relies on objectification.
I think a lot of it's to do with an assumption the hierarchy is necessary and desirable. And so when I've heard people talk about either human nature or social arrangements, social structure, they have this idea that they just, you have to have, chiefs and Indians. You've got to have leaders and followers, because otherwise nothing's going to work, And so they have an idea that equality itself is a problem. And so that therefore hierarchy is set up. And of course, what is, the exploitation of other animals if it's not based on hierarchical thinking?
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, ultimately, somebody I once had a long, long conversation with on this issue asked me to define anarchy and what an anarchist world would look like, and I said it would be a world without hierarchy, was my first comment about it. And I think one thing about that shows us the strength of capitalist mind control, if you like, is that people find that almost impossible to conceive of. I mean, I don't know completely what that would look like. Nobody does, you know? But that's ultimately the anarchist message, a world without hierarchy. And to me, when I hear that, how can you separate anarchy and veganism? Because their message is the same. A world without hierarchy means freedom for all sentient beings.
World without hierarchy for a lot of people means things don't get done. I remember doing this kind of exercise in sociology, and what people would do is actually conceive of something like a single supermarket and say, well, how can you function without, department heads and then a manager and an assistant manager, this kind of thing. And so a demarcation of roles are necessary, but authority is needed, somebody kind of giving the orders, really.
We're so conditioned to believe that, aren't we? Because if we weren't, we would be so much more of a threat. Because if we had faith in those around us and in ourselves, we would be potential revolutionaries. And that's what capitalism wants to stop, If we didn't defer all the decisions to someone above our head, whether it's a boss, a religious figure, someone with increased social standing, if we didn't defer all the important decisions to someone over our heads, we would be making some important decisions for ourselves. We would be questioning stuff. And that's the one thing capitalism does not want, any questioning. You obey and you give orders. And that is how life works. And the thing is, we just basically, again, as we will touch on in the next podcast, we need to liberate our imaginations from this repressive, stifling belief we have in the inevitability and necessity of a hierarchical way of doing things. Yes, things wouldn't get done in the same way anymore. Things would be done in a profoundly different way. The world would work in a profoundly different way. But it would work better, No one would be silenced, no one would be forgotten or marginalised. Everyone would have a voice.
Or as you say in your one of your posters of late, everyone matters and no one is forgotten.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so let's turn to a different topic. And this is the dread idea of scare words, Tina, where there is still this feeling within the movement that veganism itself is a scare word, and I get the impression that intersectionality is rapidly seen as that, and maybe even a distraction too, in the sense that here we're our job is to establish veganism as the moral baseline concept, and now we're diluting it, we're deflecting it with this idea of intersectionality. Now, you're not going to go with that, but can you explain why?
I can have a go, because it's something that continually disappoints me, and I can't fully explain it. But I think there's a few reasons, and again, some of them aren't very pleasant, so prepared to be insulted, everybody. But I just don't see how intersectionality cannot make us stronger. I mean, how can a broader understanding of justice, how can the idea of veganism as being something bigger, as being a vision of a whole non-violent world, how can that be dilution, distraction, scary? It doesn't make sense, What? That is a I agree that it's a profoundly challenging idea, particularly to people who aren't ready to accept the parts they play in upholding forms of privilege, you know? You know, that's a really disappointing thing for me. It's like, if you remember, when we were posting some of our events on Indymedia, we got a lot of kind of very unfavourable, aggressive responses from folks about this idea of intersectionality. And one of the most prominent challenges to that idea seemed to be, well, let's unite against the common enemy, i.e., let's fight capitalism, and we can get rid of sexism afterwards. And significantly, it's always men saying that. It's just like, for some reason, sexist oppression is come to be seen as kind of some peripheral, unimportant little issue which is only brought to our attention by women who are being excessively sensitive, should toughen up, couldn't survive in the real world, etc., etc. Those were all points made to me when I objected to this challenge. And I think to some extent, what we're seeing among animal advocates in response to introducing this idea of intersectionality is part of the same thing. Like, I don't know. I'm the first to admit that it takes a lot of kind of dedication, consistency, being very self-critical. These are all anarchist ideals, you know? And they're ideals which we're all working towards, so I'm in no way saying that I embody what I'm talking about. I don't think anybody does yet, because we're all still dealing with all this internalized oppression. We're all still working towards that ideal of perfect freedom, perfect responsibility. So I'm not saying I've got it right, everyone else has got it wrong, but I am saying, I am expressing my anger and disappointment, frankly, at predominantly male animal advocates who come back at the idea of intersectionality with this kind of, it's excessive political correctness, it's distraction, you know, I want it to still mean one little thing. And when you get that kind of response, you think, it's okay for people who are privileged by patriarchy rather than oppressed by it to say that. It's okay for you, for it to be a subject you can joke about. It's not funny to me, you know, and it's just, it's okay for you to say that it's an issue of hypersensitivity. As I said, excessive political correctness doesn't feel that way to the victims of this kind of oppression. It's just, all that challenge to intersectionality is, it's like, oh, we're dealing with too many things at once here, let's keep it simple, blah, blah, blah. That has two key elements, as I see it. One is this mentality of selling something. Like, we have to keep the idea really small or people won't grasp it, and you just think, you cannot keep a revolution small. A revolution is something that's dynamic, it's not static, it grows, it changes, it gains strength from its continual changing. And you cannot limit it, you cannot shove it in a box, you cannot sell it. You know, you just can't do that.
Even if not small, it's still got to be understandable. Isn't that part of the critique?
Who can not understand that we live in an oppressive world which objectifies women and our fellow animals, for example? Who can not understand that the mentality of those who oppress with their language, their attitudes, the way that they conduct their lives, say, women, are similar in these attitudes to those who oppress people of colour, to those who oppress our fellow animals? Who can not see that all these things are linked? That is really simple. Basically, the idea of an intersectional understanding of veganism, it is this simple. We do not want to hurt anybody. That's
it. It's the same mentality as wanting to use the word like Holocaust is. I mean, that's a kind of an intersectional kind of statement in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's trying to link two things together. Do you think, on a very practical level, that some fear is that you know, if you take an intersectional approach, you'll be saying veganism less? You know, actually physically saying it less?
Well, that's a misconception. We're not trying to replace the word veganism, you know? We're trying to challenge the boundaries which we have constructed around the idea of veganism. I just don't understand why that's a problem. Who does not want to strive to lead, as far as possible, a just, harmless, non-violent life? Who would not welcome the idea of veganism meaning something so awesome? You know, it's just...
Well, it certainly chimed with the founders, the early pioneers of veganism, that's for sure.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's another common misconception, that it wouldn't, you know? And I just think the idea that, oh, veganism means this, so let's stick with this. I just think, when did we last take a critical, revolutionary look at what our movement means? I think an issue we're seeing on all sides here, from the anti-capitalists who don't want to think about veganism, from the vegans who don't want to think about capitalism or sexism or racism, blah, 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 I think an issue we're seeing here is kind of a movement privilege issue. I want to still be an advocate for other animals, and I want to be free to make crude sexist jokes whenever I want, for example, you know? And I don't want that to mean I'm not a vegan. You know, I want it to be easy to call myself a vegan. You know, I don't want to have to be that self-critical, that consistent. Ultimately, I don't want to have to be that revolutionary.
And then we're back to the construction of the boxes that we talked about in the first of the first podcast, if you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you see, I can see that there should be a marked difference between the grassroots and the non-grassroots here, because you can see there's all kind of business reasons why people want to keep in a box. You know, not upset their members, and you know, not upset potential subscribers and everything else in terms of the business, you know, the international, the national groups, this kind of thing. But for the grassroots, they should be open to intersectionality much more, I would have thought.
Yes, and it's disappointing that that hasn't really proved to be the case so far. But I just think, it's hard.
You're working on it.
Yeah, definitely. It's just hard for me to see why it's supposed to be divisive. Intersectionality is an idea which unites, in principle. You know, that's essentially what it is. It is the idea that we are each other. It's like, if you are, you know, if you were defending women against patriarchal society, you are one of us. You know,
I think you're right, though, but I think that the problem is contained in what you've already said. We accept it unites, but then it gets too much. And, you know, anyway, one thing at a time. So, you know, those strands, you know, kind of come together as a bit of a recipe, as a package, you know, where people are going, we do have to sell something. We've got to sell the idea of veganism. And now we've got to do this, and then we've got to do that, you know. And so let's keep it simple.
Yeah, well,
there's
a very practical reason why that doesn't work, and incidentally, you know, I'm continually astonished by people seeming to think that they can express revolution or contain revolution in a soundbite, but anyway, there is a practical reason why that idea doesn't work, because it cannot happen like that. For example, say we keep veganism within its box, it simply means the liberation of our fellow animals. In a non-human box sense. How do you get that within capitalism? Capitalism would collapse. As David Nybert points out, capitalism cannot survive animal liberation.
And this is why Nybert says, whether we like it or not, it's a prerequisite.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, to take it beyond this, I, as a radical feminist, believe capitalism could not survive women's liberation either. Because it's, as I've said, capitalism sells rape culture in the form of fashion, in the form of making anorexia glamorous, etc., etc. Capitalism kills women, you know?
It's all interlinked, it's all entangled, and it's all intersectional. I mean, it is, you know, the full understanding of that lays it out in front of us, what we've got to do.
Yes, I also think that the revolution in that sense, an intersectional understanding of revolution would change us. So you cannot have a situation where you've come across, you've somehow... We've done animal liberation first. We've got a world which is non-violent towards other animals, and yet it still objectifies and enslaves women. It's still an ableist world. It's still a homophobic world. It's still a capitalist world. How is all that violence contained in a world which also has accepted and embraced the idea of animal liberation? It doesn't work. You don't have this sort of strata of different forms of oppression. Do that, then do this. It would be...
No, I mean, putting it that way, it doesn't work, and moreover, it couldn't work that
way. No, it's a dynamic whole, you know? It's a whole new way of being, and a whole new way of thinking, relating to others, etc. And what I'm essentially saying here, what I essentially want the message of this whole podcast to be... is that the reason I'm challenging the idea of veganism, or indeed any liberation movement within a box, is that you cannot confine empathy, justice, respect within boxes. They go further, they have to, otherwise they lose all meaning. And as soon as you start considering the implications of treating those around you with respect and fighting for the liberation of others, those ideas just grow and grow, and that's what's awesome about them.
Yeah, and which, by the way, obviously is the basic premise of the animal rights movement, which is based on some human rights thinking. And so that's also saying the same thing. Okay, we've got this idea, but the scope is wrong. We can't contain it in the human box. We've got to burst through the species barrier.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. Essentially, what's intersectionality is a theory for examining our oppression and our privilege is saying is that we have to break down all the barriers.
Across the board.
Yeah.